that the lion's share of the profits go to the creators, manufacturers, and developers. In reality, it is often the people who serve the developers and manufacturers who generate a higher return on what they have invested in their businesses. Real estate management, not development, is one of the most profitable businesses in America. This is the case no matter how one measures profitability. Those who serve are typically the winners in the economic race. It's what I call the rock and roll dilemma. Your son wants to become a recording artist. He tells you that the Stones are making hundreds of millions. Or your daughter wants to be an author, and she quotes from Publishers Weekly that John Hancock Jr. just signed a $2 million deal with a major publisher. It sounds wonderful, but the odds are long that anyone will ever make a dollar of profit singing, writing, developing, or manufacturing. And those who beat the odds will have to share the revenue big time. The agents are the ones who gain the largest rate of return on their so-called investments. Consider this example. It may take an author 3,000 hours to research and write a book that eventually becomes a bestseller. His literary agent normally earns 15% of his royalties. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a great deal if you figure it by hours invested. The author invests his life, his career, his 3,000 hours. The agent may invest as little as 100 hours marketing the manuscript. The publisher sells 1 million copies and the author gets 15% of the $20 retail price, or $3 million. The agent earns $450,000, or 15% of $3 million. This leaves $2,550,000 for the author. Now normalize these numbers. The author earned $2,550,000 divided by 3,000 hours, or $850 per hour. The agent's hourly wage, however, is $450,000 divided by 100 hours invested, or $4,500 per hour. If the agent had allocated 3,000 hours, the expected return would be $13.5 million, or more than five times what the author received for his 3,000 hours of work. And the agent doesn't have to go on tour or do book signings. Who is better off financially? Do you want to be a manager, investment banker, attorney, agent, server, marketer of talent, or manager of real estate? Or do you want to be the developer, manufacturer, or creator of books? I will tell you what I tell my children. The smart people place their bets on the servers. They have questioned this response, so I shared the figures given above with them. But I also told them there are more than 300,000 books published each year, and 2 out of 3 never make it to the bookstores. Of those 100,000 that do get distributed, few ever sell 1 million copies or more. My own estimates are that about 0.1% get close to the million mark. There are thousands of authors who have spent thousands upon thousands of hours researching and writing books and never sold more than 10,000 copies. None of them earned more than $10,000. And several of these authors were brilliant in their respective fields. Given these facts, why do so many people want to be authors, developers, or even manufacturers? Certainly there are some issues of status involved, but in reality most people don't know the odds of making even a single dollar of profit in such endeavors. Even worse, they don't initially appreciate the extraordinary amount of dollars at risk and the other resources required. If Jim R. had the profitability data beforehand, he wouldn't have made the transition from real estate manager to highly leveraged developer. He was overwhelmed by the euphoria of beginner's luck because he did well as a manager. He had some early success with his development company, but economic euphoria can easily cloud one's vision. This is especially true when success is encountered at a young age, and Jim, before he was 28, had developed units in 5 states. All the while, he had not encountered a single setback to his business. Economic euphoria had a lot to do with Jim's business decisions and lifestyle at the time. At the tender age of 28, I was the largest personal bankruptcy in Florida history. But it was a great ride. I had a villa in Acapulco, I had a Learjet, personal apartments in 12 cities, and a different girlfriend in every city. Jim lost it all. His real estate development business was highly leveraged, and so was his lifestyle. When interest rates climbed suddenly, his young empire collapsed. Overnight, he literally went from the penthouse back to his mom and dad's house. His grandmother even chipped in by giving Jim the keys to her old Studebaker. But he wasn't down for long. Shortly after his reversal, he accepted a position with a large commercial real estate management company. And there, he says, I learned a lot of good lessons coupled with what I had learned during my business failure. Jim then spent 2 years as regional executive for the management firm, and there he learned a lot about real estate finance. Once again, he went out on his own and founded his own management firm. In addition, he purchased properties for investment purposes. In spite of his previous setback, Jim also developed a variety of condominiums and apartments. After several very productive and profitable years, Jim sensed that the real estate market was about to tumble. He liquidated all his holdings just ahead of the crash and focused on his property management business. One of Jim's major clients was a large commercial bank for which he managed several investment properties. Often, the bank found it necessary to foreclose on a real estate development it had financed, and they hired Jim as a consultant. He provided them with advice concerning the liquidation of assets. In some cases, Jim realized that the developments would ultimately be winners if completed on a timely basis. One that the bank ended up owning was a large upscale residential subdivision with its own country club. The club included a fine 18-hole golf course, multiple tennis courts, swimming pools, and a large, well-appointed clubhouse. The bank faced a dilemma. Should it just sell or liquidate each remaining builder lot, there were hundreds, the partially completed homes, and the country club? Or would it be better to take over the project and complete the development? Jim's advice was to the point. The only way the bank could avoid losing millions and millions of dollars was to complete the development. But the bank was not in the construction business, so it wanted Jim to manage the construction and completion of the project. Since Jim did have experience managing construction projects, he accepted the bank's proposition. Managing construction resources was second nature to Jim, but there was a related problem. Imagine that you are a prospective home buyer in that subdivision. Would you purchase a home in a country club setting without the country club being fully operational? Probably not. The club had to be open and operating if buyers were going to pay decent prices for homes in the development. The bank's problem became a major economic opportunity for Jim, and for that reason he considers himself one of the most fortunate men today. He had an outstanding track record for managing various projects, so once again the bank turned to him to solve the club problem. He managed it for them. Jim had never done anything quite like that before, and he told me he had never tended bar or played golf. But he looked at the experience as a great opportunity to learn while being paid to do it. I just had to learn. I used their nickels for 2 years and really learned the club business. The actual club business was a result of taking over the completion of the subdivision, to finish up the houses, the streets, the sewers, the water. 2 years after Jim took over the club and completion of the development, it was a success. Nearly all the homes were completed and sold, and the club was up and running smoothly. But the bank still worried about the club. If they sold it, the new owners might not operate it at the high level committed to the members, and the bank's reputation would be damaged. The bank again called on its number one problem solver, Jim. He was presented with an extraordinary opportunity. The bank gave him a sweetheart deal on the purchase price, and a great deal on a loan package to finance the purchase. Jim soon realized that owning and managing clubs was far better than being in the real estate development business. He discovered that no matter how good he was as a developer, the market dictated his success or failure. In his mind, property management is a better business. It provides a steady stream of income, and it allows Jim full use of his abilities and aptitudes. His extraordinary leadership and organizational skills match up perfectly with the requirements necessary to manage exclusive clubs effectively. So his accidental vocation has become his career of choice for more than 20 years. Early experiences. Today, when Jim wonders how this all happened, he realizes that it began with his grandmother. When he was still a young boy, she taught him the value of discipline, hard work, and being self-employed. She also tutored him in the art of recognizing and capitalizing on economic opportunities. His rapid ascent to millionaire status before age 28 and his subsequent bankruptcy tempered him. His hard work, especially with one major bank, was rewarded. His success was not dumb luck. Jim believes that if you seek out opportunity and work hard, you will be amazed at how much luck will come your way. One of Jim's sons recently graduated from college. He expressed an interest in working in his dad's management business. How did Jim respond to his son's proposition? "I required him to go somewhere else for 3 or 4 years before he comes into the business." Where will his son receive the leadership training to manage 200 employees and several businesses? According to Jim, the answer is the U.S. Marine Corps Officers Candidate Program. After spending 3 years in the Marines, he will be mature, become a leader. Jim is a strong believer in the benefits of military training. It's essential that his son learn to lead and manage people, and Jim also believes that his own military experience enhanced his ability to seize the initiative and to get along with people. Certainly, these qualities are a major reason why Jim is successful today, but they had their origin long before Jim joined the U.S. Army. Jim's grandmother was his mentor. She was a dyed-in-the-wool entrepreneur and farmer. Even before he was 6 years old, she encouraged him to make his own way, and she trained him to recognize economic opportunities when they presented themselves. She first introduced Jim to the world of free enterprise with an offer. Jim would be given 1/2 interest in a cow and the revenue from its milk if he milked the cow every morning. Jim did so well in this task that his grandmother gave him a bonus. He was granted ownership in the calves that the cow produced. Most people don't have Jim's eye for opportunity, but they probably didn't have a grandmother like his. She even encouraged Jim to appreciate the economic opportunities associated with cow manure. "I started bagging the cow manure from the barn. I sold it to people who used it to grow tomatoes." Jim's folks were good providers of basic food, clothing, and shelter. But even when he was a small boy, they told him that if he wanted anything other than "my basic needs," I had to earn it. He did have more than basic needs, so he was motivated to earn extra cash. But it was his grandmother who taught him the benefits of owning, managing, and caring for his income-producing assets. "There were life lessons there. My grandmother said, 'Take care of this cow, this calf, and they will give you milk.'" She often lectured Jim about the creed of the financially independent business owner. "If you can't figure out how to make money for yourself, you're going to be working for the other fellow all your life." A career of working for someone else is a cardinal sin for Jim. He believes that one must always be sensitive to the benefits of leveraging relationships and economic opportunities. He learned how to do that while still in high school. During his freshman year, Jim persuaded a local veterinarian, whose services his family had used for many years, to hire him. Jim worked for the veterinarian during all his high school years. He worked every afternoon on school days, every weekend, and full-time during the summer. When he was first employed there, Jim came up with an idea to leverage his position by raising golden retrievers. This sideline was rather profitable. Jim was able to purchase dog food at wholesale prices because of his relationship with his employer. Many of the veterinary fees normally associated with raising dogs were either waived or provided at a significant discount. And Jim was readily able to sell his golden retriever puppies through the communications network that his employer enjoyed. When Jim entered college, he had to give up this great job and his sideline as a breeder. He thought that college would teach him how to make a living, but he didn't realize that he already knew how to support himself, thanks to his grandmother's life lessons. A vocation studied in college. Joe Smith's case analysis highlights another successful millionaire's choice of vocation, but one that's a bit different from other business owners. Only 36% of the business owners indicated that an important factor underlying their choice of vocation was directly related to courses studied in college. Mr. Smith is in the hardware business. He owns and manages a small chain of extremely productive hardware stores. What can one learn about hardware business in college? It all depends on the orientation of the student. If you knew while you were still in college exactly what you wanted to do for the rest of your working life, you would have a goal, a roadmap. You'd know why you were there and what you want to do when you complete college. Thus, you would probably take college seriously and select a major that would be useful in your career. You could look at every concept in each course with one major issue in mind. How can I use this knowledge given my chosen vocation? In each course that Joe Smith took from his third year of college on, he became a collector of wisdom and ideas. It's unusual for most students to have such clear goals about their chosen vocation, and thus their actions are not goal-oriented. The collector's mentality is very important in explaining economic productivity. While Joe was in college, several changes in his life molded him into a collector. He began collecting courses in the business school that could help him make a retail hardware operation more productive. In each course, he'd ask himself, "What concepts in this course can I leverage in helping make my operation more productive?" But during Joe's first 2 years in college, he was not a collector. He wasn't even sure why he was attending college. Nor did he make the connection between what he learned in college and how it might be applied to his vocation someday. Joe's dad started his career as a counter clerk at a hardware store and later opened a small hardware store of his own. Joe was never much involved with his dad's business, and his father believed that a college degree would be the key to his son's success. He assumed that once his son had a degree, he would automatically be qualified to run the hardware business. His dad often told him, "Joe, I want you to go to college to learn how to run this business, so we can be a big success with it." At first, Joe was a marginal student. He really didn't have much interest in school, and he never connected his schoolwork with hardware. "So I went to the university for 2 years, a preliminary 2 years, I guess you'd call it, never learned anything about the hardware business." Then, in the summer between Joe's sophomore and junior year, his father died. Joe was now in charge of his family's business, and he still wanted to fulfill his dad's wish for a college graduate in the family. "So I went to the state college part-time. I continued there, 4 years, part-time student, and running the hardware business, too." Sink or swim, it was now all in Joe Smith's hands. A 20-year-old was responsible for running a business and supporting his family. Fear and adversity can be great motivators, and that was the case with Joe. While he sat in every class, he always asked himself the same question. "I kept asking myself what I'm going to learn that's going to help me in this business." I did learn, and did graduate. Joe was transformed into a collector of wisdom while attending night school. At that time, he began to realize the importance of his accounting class and related business courses. Even his English courses now seemed important. After all, he had to write many letters and reports as part of his job description. Joe became a straight-A student and graduated in the top 5% of his class. He did a lot more than merely take over his dad's operation. He transformed it into one of the most profitable retail operations in this country. Learning to play defense and offense. I have never interviewed one successful business owner who is not cost-sensitive. It matters little if it's a retail hardware operation, a legal practice, or a junkyard. Defense, that is, paying very close attention to expenses, is the foundation of productivity. A business that does not control costs is out of control. What did young Joe Smith know about costs and expenses? Very little to start. But Joe began collecting information about playing great defense from his accounting books and class lectures. Then he applied this knowledge every day in running the hardware operation. Mr. Smith, "I figured out that if I was going to be a success at that business, I had to buckle down and learn every little in and out of that business. So every little expense and every little cost and every little thing I kept my finger on." Dr. Stanley, "Joe, where did you find the time to operate a business, go to night school, study, and then keep track of all those expenses?" Mr. Smith, "I do a lot of that before work. I get up early in the morning and come in before work, prior to the store opening." While Joe became a master of controlling expenses, he also began collecting something else. Most successful business owners realize that customers are collected one by one. Joe developed a strong customer base by locating and relocating stores at ideal intercept points. His stores were also located adjacent to areas where large concentrations of ideal hardware customers lived or worked. It isn't enough just to be physically closer to customers. You must have empathy for their needs. You must take the time and energy to study their needs, and then make certain that you stock your stores with offerings that reflect these needs. Joe Smith woke up each day at 5 a.m. and arrived at his office before 6 a.m. Then he would study the cost data. He studied the sales and profitability numbers for each item sold. Just before the flagship store opened, he'd position himself in the front. During the day, I would post myself up front. I would be sure that everybody was waited on, that they got what they needed. I figured that if anyone came to the business, they had a need. If I had to send them someplace else, we weren't supplying the people's needs. That is our philosophy. Major home improvement warehouses are opening up more and more stores in Joe's region, but his business keeps improving. Even in the hardware business, it's possible to win by specializing, by developing a market or competitive niche. Dr. Stanley, can you give us some specifics about how you compete? Mr. Smith, lots of little things, innumerable small amounts of things. You find your niche, find out what works for you, and do it. Our business is not like any other hardware business. We sell things no one else sells. We found there was a demand for that. If there is demand for certain items and only you offer them, you have a niche. Joe realized that many customers were always popping up, searching for particular items that no one else in the market area carried. He capitalized on that need, and in so doing, he collected customers by responding to their unique needs. For example, we stock stainless steel pipe fittings. You would not find them in any other hardware store. But there's demand, so we'll stock a wide variety. It brings in trade. And we have O-ring cabinets. So what I'm saying is if you're open enough to observe, you will find a niche, and it will work. Joe continually redefines his vocation with periodic updates that reflect changes in customer demand. That's all part of being a collector. Today, he can trace his demonstrated ability to collect knowledge, market information, and customers back to his years in night school, where he learned to value knowledge and information. Collecting knowledge and information has economic value only if you are focused and have specific business goals. If you don't have a niche, then you may collect nothing, or you will collect things that don't matter. A few days before Christmas, I was having lunch at a restaurant close to Joe's flagship store. So after lunch, I went hardware shopping. The place was packed with shoppers, but I discovered that's true most of the time, not just at the holidays. In spite of the crowd, I was greeted and offered assistance. Clerks were everywhere helping people. It didn't matter how small the purchase or how unique the problem, the clerks were all attentive. Many of Joe's patrons at this flagship store are millionaire homeowners. Typically, their homes were built before World War II, so they often need something replaced. Whether it's a light switch or a crack that needs filling, both the do-it-yourself millionaire and the one who hires repair talent get their hardware from Mr. Smith's. A generalization about a specific. Allow me to make a point. The students who get the most out of their formal education are those who fully realize the specific value of what they are studying. They are the ones who have the least difficulty earning their degrees and who get the most out of their programs. While I was a graduate student, I noted that people with some teaching or work experience prior to entering our program had a very clear understanding of the value of their coursework and research. Many others had problems motivating themselves to perform at a high level in each course. They asked, why should a PhD candidate in marketing have to study mathematical statistics, macroeconomics, and microeconomics? In the program I completed, we had the equivalent of a master's degree in both statistics and economics by the time we graduated. 7 4-hour qualifying exams in statistics, quantitative analysis, microeconomics, and macroeconomics, then an 8-hour exam in one's major. It was easier to deal with all this if you had a firm grip on your future job description. Along with many of my classmates, I had taught before entering the PhD program. We all realized that having a PhD was like having a union card. it's nearly impossible to be hired by a major university if you don't have one. If you really enjoy teaching and lecturing and want to enhance and broaden your skills, then you are likely to find some element in each and every course that will help you reach your goal. When I studied, I kept the same picture in my mind. It was a vision of myself, lecturing with the material I was studying to a classroom filled with attentive students. The same technique works even today. When I write books, I envision readers who, hopefully, will increase their economic productivity by reading my material. You must have a goal if you want to be economically successful. It is so much easier to get through the basic training of college if you know what you will be doing for the rest of your working life. That is why so many pre-med students can successfully complete the rigors of difficult undergraduate courses. Conversely, just try to generate straight A's in all those science courses for the sake of a mere letter grade. It's much easier if you keep your eye and mind off a goal. If you are without goals, college may be a nightmare. The earlier in life you determine what you really want to do, really want to become, the easier and more purposeful your training will be. That's why so many students who have work experience eventually do well in life. Just ask the Joe Smiths of this world. What if you have a goal in mind but you still generate poor grades? Some of the most successful entrepreneurs today were once C, D, or even F students. Many were working full-time and pursuing a college degree full or near full-time. Others went the night school route, but they all had some self-confidence because of their ongoing work experience and focus on a vocational goal. Many had something else that helped them select the ideal vocation. Their parents, often during mealtime, discussed stories about economically successful people. Newspapers, magazines, books, and even personal experiences were the sources for these stories. It doesn't take much time to share this type of information with children, and the benefits of teaching them to begin conceptualizing their ideal vocation early in life can be enormous. On becoming a collector. When did I become a serious collector? It was June 1980, when I was first introduced to John Robin, founder of the premier geocoding firm in this country. We both served on the same task force assembled by a client. John had devised a way to segment efficiently the household population by neighborhood. This concept was the key to targeting the marketing, advertising, promoting, and distributing of products and services. On this project, John's input was needed to estimate the size of the millionaire population, and he had a statistical model that estimated the average net worth of each neighborhood in America. My job was to design questionnaires and survey methodology, analyze the survey responses, and prepare a strategic market report. John ranked each neighborhood in this country according to its average net worth, and then I surveyed millionaires in those neighborhoods that contained the highest concentrations of wealthy households. The moment John made his first presentation on the distribution of millionaire households, a light went on inside my head. What he told us was that many so-called upscale neighborhoods had few millionaires, while some had a disproportionately large number. Similarly, about one-half of all millionaires do not live in so-called upscale neighborhoods. I was completely fascinated by this information and its implications. John's presentation lit the spark for much of my work since then. I have been a serious collector of information about wealthy people. I wasn't certain how the information would ultimately be presented, and I wasn't even sure what major dimensions would ultimately appear. But I kept collecting concepts, squirreling away all the facts I could find about the topic of millionaires. An imaginary dialogue. Question. Dr. Stanley, how do you go about finding all the other millionaires that you profile in detail? Answer. Often I read their trade journals. Question. You mean the Wall Street Journal and the like? Answer. Not really. I'm referring to publications that target members of well-defined industries. Question. Could you give me an example? Answer. I will give you several, but assume for a moment that you own a small chain of pizza restaurants. What publications would you be interested in reading? You would likely read a trade journal that will give you critical information about trends, competition, tactics, products, markets, strategies, and suppliers. you would read Pizza Today. Or if you're in the muffler business, you'd read Exhaust News. Or if you wish to find some bargain on earth-moving equipment, Rock and Dirt. If I want to find and then interview the top veterinarian in America, I refer to the current issues of Bovine Veterinarian, Swine Practitioner, and Equine Practice. Occasionally, I even read Publishers Weekly. My most recent acquisition is Tugboat Review. Question. That's hysterical. Do you really read Tugboat Review? Answer. Yes, and it's funny that no one else except Tom Stanley ever bothered to interview some of the most economically successful people in America who are featured in trade journals. What's funny is that the national media asked me to find millionaires for them to interview. ABC's 2020 asked, The Wall Street Journal asked, Money, Success, and many others asked the same question. Question. How many trade journals are there in the country? Answer. Nearly 10,000 by my own estimate. I think that readers of The Millionaire Mind will be enlightened when they read the profiles of people whom I identify from these trades. Again, a big question answered in this section relates to how people discovered the benefits of being in businesses featured in Pit and Quarry, Trade a Plane, Pork, Waste News, Alaska Commercial Fisherman, and the Dixie Contractor. The answer is simple. Most millionaires don't feel the need to have their story told in the Wall Street Journal, in Money, or on 2020. They prefer to be featured in their industry's trade. They enjoy their status as Turkey World's cover story or Exhaust News Man of the Year. Over the years, I've been impressed with many of these trade journals. Not only do they feature America's millionaires, many of the owners of these trades have also become multimillionaires through their vocation. Question. But don't most of the owners or publishers of trade journals have a lot of experience and capital behind them? Answer. Not necessarily. In fact, a lot of the founders of various trade journals had no experience in publishing at all. Most were not even journalism majors in college. Note the comments made to me recently by the founder of Pizza Today, one of the top trades in America. Dear Tom, I was pleased to hear of your familiarity with our business-to-business title, Pizza Today. I assure you, this magazine has been an absolute joy to conceive and execute, just filled with exciting and entertaining moments. For example, in the early months of startup, an excited advertiser called to ask how we got our business stationery to smell just like a pizza shop. I told him that was a trade secret. But in fact, it was both easy and automatic, since during the first 2 years of our existence, the magazine, trade show, and trade association shared space in my small Indiana pizzeria. Storage was at a premium, and the pizza spices were kept on a shelf next to the envelopes and letterhead of the magazine, which absorbed the distinctive odors like a sponge. Enjoy the reacquaintance of our magazine and past Pizza Expo programs. I look forward to talking more at length about your possible participation in our show. Sincerely yours, Jerry Durnell, founding editor and publisher. Question. Are you telling me a boy who ran a small pizzeria started a multi-million-dollar publishing firm? Answer. Absolutely. Today he is the major force in the entire trade association, including Pizza Today and Pizza Expo. But he was not originally part of any publishing company, nor did he major in journalism. He was a hands-on pizzeria owner in Santa Claus, Indiana. He wanted to read a trade journal about pizza, but one did not exist 15 years ago, so he started his own. He knew there was a market need because he was part of it. Leveraging one's collection. Eventually, I realized that the insights about the wealthy I was collecting would make exciting reading for book buyers. After years of collecting data, interviews, research reports, and surveys, it wasn't hard for me to produce a unique work that has fascinated and helped many readers. When people ask how long it took, I refer them to June 1980. It may sound like a lot of work for a long time, but I love my job, and I'm never bored. If you love your work and it excites you every day, know that your chosen vocation is one that allows full use of your abilities and aptitudes. Get high self-esteem from your work. are absolutely certain that your vocation will make you financially independent one day, then you should have no difficulty focusing on your goal and working at a high level of productivity. All this revolves around your becoming a collector of data and information that have value if they are concentrated. Too many people today lack focus. They are not collectors of anything. Not data, not customers, not specific marketable skills. On the other hand, collectors can read one newspaper and find several ideas or pieces of information about their chosen vocation. In 20 years, they can generate a collection of treasure. Non-collectors often don't understand what they should be doing given their aptitudes and abilities. They can read thousands of newspapers and not add one item to their collection. Perhaps they never started one. Or, worse, they hate their jobs. In the long run, it's impossible to work at a high level of productivity if you dislike your work. The key is to find the job that's well-suited to your talents, and then it's easier to fall in love with it. But you should also find one that has the potential to make you rich. If you account for these factors, you'll be amazed at how well-disciplined you become. Time and work hours pass quickly when you're having fun. The ideal vocation is not always easy to find. In fact, most millionaires told me they had several other jobs before they found the ideal one. If they had been content to stay with that first job they accepted right out of college, or if they had stayed in a job they disliked and were not content with, then most would never, ever be millionaires today. Often it's something in our past, some training or work experience that leads to the idea for that ideal vocation. Look for ways to fill market needs that others have ignored, those with little or no competition. Start thinking about and conceptualizing it today. The very best vocations that I find in my research on millionaires are genuinely unique. Even areas that seem traditional can have some degree of uniqueness. I was trained to be a plain old marketing professor, but I selected a specific, unique topic of research that has enabled my success. Tom Stanley's Discovery Factors. I know that past exposure can influence the search for the ideal vocation from my own life experience. When I was a boy, we lived in a small apartment in a blue-collar section of the Bronx. Just a quarter mile away was the wealthiest neighborhood in New York City, a residential community called Fieldston. The neighborhood had a high concentration of extraordinary single-family homes. To my young eyes, they could have been in Sherlock Holmes movies. They had everything but moats and alligators. I was 9 years old. I told my 11-year-old sister, "Sissy, you know, I'm disgusted with the marginal propensity of the people in our own blue-collar neighborhood to give to trick-or-treaters on Halloween. I think we need to move out of our blue-collar neighborhood on Halloween night and go to Fieldston." She said, "Great, Tommy, let's do it." So Tommy, Barbara, and two of her friends began by cold-calling a home on Waldo Avenue in Fieldston. First home identified. 2 acres in New York City. Large gate, large wall, 150 feet from the street, no lights on. My sister said to me, "It's your idea, you go to the front, we'll stay out here." I knocked on the door for 5 minutes. Finally, it opened up, and there in front of me was James Mason, the distinguished British actor. Facing him was Tommy Stanley, the 9-year-old Halloween commando. I said, "Trick or treat." He said, "Young man, I have no candy." I said, "Mr. Mason, sir, there are two parts to this equation. Where do you want to go from here?" That was my first affluent experience. He said to me, and I'll never forget him, ascot and all, "Young man, I'll give you all the silver in the house." Whoa, what did he mean? I was about to find out. He left the door ajar and went back into the house. Then my sister showed up and said, "Tommy, what's going on?" I said, "Barbara, it's either coins, flatware, or some combination of both." That kind man gave us 2 handfuls of nickels, dimes, quarters, and half dollars, the equivalent of what we would have received if we had trick-or-treated at 300 blue-collar households. That's what it means to be wealthy in America. After we landed Mr. Mason as our first Halloween client, we noticed that the lights were on at the English Tudor-style home across the street. But our forecast changed as we approached the house. There was a sign attached to the front door, "Attention, trick-or-treaters, my husband is ill, don't ring, don't knock. you'll find coins in the milk box. I said to myself, coins in the milk box indeed, stiffing young people. These folks just put a few pennies in the box and went inside and locked the door. I opened the milk box and guess what? Treasure Island. It was loaded with more than 20 business envelopes with lovely black writing on them. The contents of this envelope are designated for a group of one or two trick-or-treaters. There were envelopes for 3, for 4, for 5, 6, and 7. 8+ was the big one, and there were 3 for each category. We removed only one envelope for the group of 4. Then we left Fieldston and went home. 20 years later, I began studying the affluent in America. Finding the right fit. Dan R.'s story isn't as straightforward as mine. How did he reach millionaire status before he was 40, earning more than $1 million in 1 year, a status earned by only one in every 1,000 households in America? Many factors contributed to Dan's success, and many trials and errors were involved. He was very wise when he eventually selected the ideal vocation, vocation, vocation. Dan is like the vast majority of first-generation millionaires, because most will tell you they selected the perfect vocation. For people who are interested in becoming wealthy in one generation, the perfect vocation is the one that allows full use of their abilities and aptitudes. 9 jobs. It took Dan R. quite a long time to introduce himself to the other 10 members of the focus group. Halfway through his presentation, I almost stopped him because I thought the recruiter had made a mistake. Dan was supposed to be a millionaire who succeeded because of his high-performance skills as a sales professional. But in his introduction, all he talked about was a series of sales positions where he either underperformed or was fired. I thought Dan was in the wrong place that night, but I let him continue, and it was a good thing I didn't interrupt. He actually documented 9 poor-performance jobs before he described how he eventually succeeded in his 10th time at bat. Consider Dan's path to finding the ideal vocation. Position 1. After graduating from a top business school with a degree in marketing, Dan took a job with a corporation selling calculators and electronic watches to large retailers. I never seemed to get the knack of it. Didn't sell a lot. After 2 years, I was asked to resign. Position 2. Dan then went to work for a major producer of electronic games, but once again I couldn't get the knack of selling and they asked me to leave about 1.5 years later. Position 3. Hired by a startup computer company, Dan resigned after 9 months of never selling one computer. Position 4. Dan was hired by a small computer company. He didn't sell much of their product either and resigned after a few months on the job. Position 5. Dan's 5th position was also with a computer company. He didn't meet his sales quota and again was asked to resign. Position 6. In Dan's next job, I was really doing well because I wasn't in sales, I was in marketing. But 9 months later, the company ran out of money and went out of business. Position 7. Dan accepted a sales position with a startup computer company. I made only $45,000 annually until the last year I was there. I made $200,000. But then the market slowed up and the company went out of business. Position 8. Dan accepted another sales job. But the company had problems with me because of low sales volume. Position 9. Dan hired on with a company that produces scanners at cash registers. They let me go. I wasn't the only one who thought Dan was in the wrong place. The fellow who sat next to him laughingly blurted out the following comment after Dan's story of position 5. I don't want to sit next to this guy anymore. Finally, at position 10, Dan's search for the ideal vocation paid dividends. 6 years ago, he found a unique career that closely fit his abilities and aptitudes. He landed a job that was entitled sales professional, but it was much more than selling as defined by most of his previous positions. This job not only required Dan to close major deals, it also called for considerable market planning, understanding of each customer's unique needs, preparing detailed proposals, and most important, focusing on major accounts. It gave Dan a lot of discretion in how he pursued business. In reality, Dan viewed his position as being more of a market consultant than merely a sales caller. Almost immediately after he began working in his 10th position, Dan recognized that he had been ill-suited to his previous jobs. They were purely sales positions, and Dan was consistently outperformed by other sales professionals because he is a thinker, not a sales commando. The most successful sales professionals were those who aggressively called on the largest number of prospective customers. Pre-planning was relegated to making appointments. But Dan was often kidded by his fellow sales professionals as one with many plans, few clients. Dan is more than a strategic planner. He has an extraordinary ability to uncover major market opportunities and generate millions of dollars in revenue from these opportunities. But it took 9 experiences with other employment situations before Dan fully conceptualized his definition of the ideal position. During these 9 equivalents of the Stations of the Cross, he often agonized. I would sit in my car and drive all around. I would get so depressed because I had all this drive and was a really hard worker. I was letting myself down and my parents down. Dan intuitively knew that there was an ideal vocation somewhere. That's why he kept looking for the opportunity that would allow him to fully utilize his aptitude as a highly intelligent and gifted marketer. If I could just find the right product and the right opportunities, I could do well. Dan realized that the computer industry gives major compensation to top-performing marketers, but that was too broad a description. It was like trying to find someone's room in a large hotel. Dan had the correct address for the hotel, but he didn't have the room number. So within the domain of marketer of computer systems, Dan began his search for the ideal combination of company, compensation package, product, and target market. He never regrets his previous experiences working in sales for 9 other employers. They helped him conceptualize his ideal vocation. 6 years ago, Dan was convinced that he'd discovered the right opportunity, one that allowed full use of his abilities. Why did he waste his time working in 9 previous positions that were unsuitable, given his aptitude and abilities? According to Dan, it took some experience with situations that were less than ideal for him to appreciate the right vocation. But he knew that he would always be the marginally productive man in sales if he remained in any of his previous positions. I would be still selling watches and calculators if I was marginally good. What was different in my case was I became a good searcher of opportunities, searcher of future or just different niche markets. A man is repeatedly fired or resigns because he fails to meet sales quotas, and then he turns around and becomes one of America's best paid, most productive revenue generators. Dan knows the reason for his success. For the last 17 years I've been searching. I'm a good searcher. I've been practicing how to search for opportunities and to look at my business in a certain way. And that's what I'm still doing today. I found this company. My first year, I made $200,000. My second, another $200,000. This success encouraged Dan to work even harder at being really focused. He realized that he'd found his niche. His marketing orientation perfectly matched the needs of his current employer, who manufactures, markets, and distributes custom-designed handheld computers. This past December, after working and planning for 5 years and getting no orders from Home Depot, I received a $35 million contract from Home Depot, selling 6,000 handheld computers to them. My W-2 read $1,033,000 commission on the check. When Dan made this statement, every one of the focus group members clapped and cheered. Every one was a self-made millionaire, and each had a similar story. They had great empathy for Dan's journey to success. Contrary to what you might expect, Dan is not constantly stressed out by his intense productive efforts. As most millionaires report, stress is a direct result of devoting a lot of effort to a task that's not in line with one's abilities. It's more difficult, more demanding mentally and physically, to work in a vocation that's unsuitable to your aptitude. It's even worse if you know that you are a round peg assigned to working square holes. Add the realization that your vocation has little or no probability of making you wealthy, and you are stressed out big time. Dan will tell you that it was more stressful earning $45,000 per year as a marginally productive sales commando than it is closing multi-million dollar deals in his current environment. Two leading scholars, Fred E. Fiedler and Thomas G. Link, recently studied the relationship between the task environment and intelligence, and reported, "Intelligent people are more likely to rely on intellectual effort in solving problems than those who have relatively low intelligence." One of the reasons Dan currently performs so well is that his employer appreciates his combination of aptitudes and abilities, while most of his previous employers did not. They preferred sales personnel who knocked down doors, if necessary, to gain immediate sales revenues. But Dan was too creative, too analytical, too deliberate, too intelligent to perform at a high level of productivity in the don't think, just sell situation. Fiedler and Link also wrote, "The stressful situations require quick and preferably automatic responses. Careful deliberation and weighing of alternatives will impede rather than assist with solution of the problem. Thus, intelligence will correlate negatively with performance." They see, but they don't see. Don spent more than an hour mulling over the comments from the other 10 members of my focus group interview. I could tell he was deep in thought as he listened to the other self-made millionaires talk about choice of vocation and economic opportunity. I was especially interested in what Don would say. He'd started a successful business more than 25 years ago and has had three other highly successful businesses since then. How did Don explain his 4-for-4 hitting streak? "You must be an opportunist. You must be an opportunist. Everyone in this room is an opportunist. In your business, Dr. Stanley, how did you get into the book business? We all have different stories, but we all had an opportunity." Does this mean that successful people are merely lucky? Did they just happen to walk into the opportunity of a lifetime? Are unsuccessful people those who just never came across a significant economic opportunity? Don asked the same rhetorical questions of the group, and all fully agreed with his answers. Everybody out there has an opportunity to get into business, the opportunity to sell somebody something. Some can't see it. You have to be able to see it. Don's discussion about seeing economic opportunity was almost word for word from the biography of Eric Hartman, the successful fighter pilot. Major Hartman often commented about combat blindness. He wondered why so many pilots had difficulty seeing the enemy target of opportunity, and he had the same problem as a rookie. "How is it possible," he asked, "that pilots with extraordinary eyesight, measured ophthalmologically, have combat blindness? These same pilots could read every letter on an eye chart at greater distances than normal, but they could not see in real combat conditions." Hartman said it best. They see, but they don't see. This is the same message Don related to the group. Don pointed out that some of the brightest people never see an opportunity staring them in the face. They received all A's on tests in college, like the fighter pilots who got all A's on eye tests. But unless you are experienced, trained, and really want to see an opportunity, you will always have combat or economic blindness. Although many people think it's a genetic trait that explains the ability to see targets of opportunity, I firmly believe people can be taught to see what others do not see. Based on scientific measures, eye charts, depth perceptions, and so forth, Hartman's eyesight didn't change much during his more than 1,400 combat missions. But his ability to see targets improved tremendously with the help of his mentors and with more and more experience. Also, he trained himself to focus his receptors in areas of the sky where he anticipated his targets would be concentrated. He could spot aircraft at a phenomenal distance, sometimes minutes before anyone else airborne with him. The vision of first-generation Americans. Think of the opportunity issue from another perspective. During the 1970s, fewer than 14 households in 1,000 had incomes of $100,000 or more, but certain groups had a greater proportion. For example, according to my analysis of 1970s data provided by the U.S. Census, Korean Americans were about 3 times more likely to have 6-figure incomes than the typical American household. the economic success enjoyed by a disproportionately large number of Korean-American households was a direct result of their ability to see economic opportunities that others overlooked. This may seem amazing given their backgrounds, because most were first generation to this country and were not college educated. Also, English was a foreign language to them. Few inherited any of their economic wealth. Their incomes came from earned sources as opposed to trust accounts. How is it possible that a group of recent arrivals to America saw significant economic opportunities, while at the same time most native-born Americans see, but they don't see? For several years, I ran an experiment in my university classes. I asked all my undergraduate, graduate, and executive MBA students this question. What are the top 10 most profitable small businesses in America? Time and time again, my students were unable to come up with even one correct answer. This ignorance about the economic opportunities in America among some of our brightest students is not for lack of genetic intelligence. I believe there are several reasons. One is that most business majors have no intention of starting their own business. They plan to work for some major corporation, so profitability is someone else's problem. Another reason is that most students are never taught about the inherent profitability of various types of businesses, perhaps because most textbook writers and professors think that profitability numbers are not technically challenging to students. But there is an even more compelling reason why our students cannot see what recent immigrants can see about significant economic opportunity. Hartman said it best. One's ability to see a target is a function of experience, training, and need. Who needs to know about the variation in profits among countless categories of business? Our sons and daughters, the well-educated, confident, and easily employed, or the first-generation Korean Americans? The answer is clear. Korean Americans came to this country with a strong desire to become financially independent. In their minds, they had one chance to accomplish the goal. Owning and operating a business was the only highway open to them. Many first-generation Korean Americans correctly chose the businesses that have a high probability of success and high profits. There are numerous Korean trade associations and Korean American cultural organizations that provide this type of information. Also, there is an informal interpersonal communication network between successful business owners and those who want to start their own enterprise. The information it supplied appears to have been quite accurate. Among the most profitable categories of business in America during the 1970s was dry cleaning. Note that there are so many Korean Americans in the dry cleaning business today that one industry trade journal publisher had no choice but to publish two versions, one in English and the other in Korean. There are many other categories of businesses that have been prime targets for perceptive Korean Americans. Just walk down Main Street, USA, and you will get a good view of the economic opportunities that some see and others ignore. Korean Americans have become a major force within a variety of profitable business categories, such as fruit and vegetable retailing and wholesaling, shoe repair, and convenience markets. They also know that if they provide a good product or service at a competitive price, they can have high expectations of economic success. In turn, economic success translates into financial independence. Seeing is not enough. Most first-generation millionaires have told me that recognition of an opportunity does not automatically translate into dollars. There must be something else in the equation. Don, a self-made millionaire, said it concisely. You have to be able to see it, then you have to believe you can do it. Belief in one's ability to succeed is a very big foundation stone. It explains much of the variation in performance among people in the vast American economy. In turn, belief in oneself is a direct result of knowing the odds are stacked in one's favor. A more detailed discussion of belief in oneself was given earlier. Why do so many businesses fail within a year or two of opening? Certainly one reason is the odds issue. Most people who select a category of business to operate don't have a clue about the real probabilities of success. Remember, it isn't how much you study and how long, it's also what you study and how well it can be leveraged in the business world. Knowing the odds of success can make all the difference. Pick a long shot and your college degree may not be enough to save you. Pick a winner and the law of economics may not punish you for never spending a day in college, never fully mastering the English language, and being born outside the United States. Don also spoke of the importance of desire. One must be highly motivated to succeed in a particular vocation. You have to have something inside of you that wants to kill. You go out and take that opportunity, that chance. You are king of the mountain. He explained that the something inside of you that wants to kill is an emotion or instinct that is vocation specific. In other words, he believes that there is some very specific vocation, product, or service out there that will excite each of us. But if we lack this emotion, this killer instinct, it's unlikely that our venture will be productive. Don feels that most people possess some of this instinct, but for many it remains dormant throughout their entire lives because they never encounter the catalyst of the ideal vocation or economic opportunity. Thus, the enormous power of this emotion will never be exploited. Every product in all of Don's four businesses was a labor of love. He loved conceptualizing the products based on his assessment of market needs, and he felt strong positive emotions about product development, design, and marketing. Without this enormous emotional energy, Don will tell you, none of his products would be a reality today. Don's emotional energy made what would be viewed as hard work by others fun for him. The risks and lifestyle sacrifices that he took as a young entrepreneur rarely entered his mind. They were easily suppressed by focusing his mind on the product and business that excited him. There is a simple lesson that can be learned from Don's experiences. Extraordinary levels of economic productivity can be accomplished by searching for and finding the vocation that evokes and conjures